outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
So Wayne, how is your 50th birthday treating you? You're just a couple days into it, correct?
50th birthday?
Your 50th birthday, right? Like you're 50 years young.
I know who I am. What do you do? I did have a birthday last week. Is that what you mean?
You did have a birthday. How was it for you?
It was a beautiful day. We went for a 5K walkathon thing for multiple myeloma, and my whole family joined me, and it was really wonderful. My kids and their kids, and a niece and her husband, and we walked 5K around Griffith Park in Los Angeles and raised some money for multiple myeloma research, and it's kind of exciting.
How did that go? How was the fundraising, and what inspired the walkathon?
It's awareness month. They use March for that. And they had it on my birthday. And I thought, I'd like to do that for my birthday. And I kind of threw it out to the kids. And boy, they responded immediately. We'd love to come. And the kids want to come. And so I didn't think anybody would. I thought it was just Sarah and me going for a walk in the park. And we had a great time. Went out to lunch afterwards. Had some chocolate cake. And it was a wonderful day. It makes it, when they started the whole thing, it makes it more of a reality, because they talk about the brave patients dealing with this disease. And I'm like, okay, I haven't felt like that yet. Maybe I should someday, but man, I hear some horror stories from this disease. So I do have some concern from time to time, but I don't know where else to leave it except in Father's hands and his love for me. And we'll just take on what we have to when it comes.
Is it still holding in remission so far? Number counts all looking good, that type of thing?
Yeah, all the numbers look great. I have had the back thing last week, which is a big alert thing, since that's where my symptoms first showed up. But it seems to just be a muscle thing. It's kind of all better now. I was able to golf over the weekend. So
that's a
pretty big deal that I could do that. So I went with my grandson, got some golf in with him, which I hadn't done in over a year. So that was
fun. Okay. How good of a golfer is your grandson?
He's getting really good. I'm telling you, guy can thump a ball. And if he had real golf clubs, he's got kind of a kid set. He's 15, but boy, he can thwack it down there when he hits it.
Nice. Okay.
I was worried about out driving him, but I could still do it.
So you got to hold on to that one for a couple more years then, huh?
I don't think it'll last that long. Maybe another couple months.
Well, best thing you heard this week.
Well, already we're there. Who are you?
I guess I'm Kyle Rice.
I'm Wayne Jacobson. And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. I tell you, the week before my birthday, I was sitting alone. Sarah was somewhere. I forget where she went. And I was alone in the house and just sitting there and just celebrated how contented I felt. I felt really contented. And it wasn't a birthday thing, I don't think. I wasn't reflecting back, but I just thought about all the things in my life that just seemed at this stage in life to fill me with contentment. And I was just sitting there thanking God for, thank you for how you've cared for me and blah, 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 blah. And then as I started to thank him for it, I was aware either by the enemy's attempt to intrude or God's attempt to teach me something, but I was aware of all the really cruddy stuff I've been through in my life. And I mean, really deep, horrible, devastating things at the times they happened, and not just like one or two of them way back somewhere, some of them a bit more recent. And I'm sitting there going, why am I so contented with my life and have those things in it that could have all been devastating, could have sidetracked me? And it just overwhelmed me even more with thanksgiving. So if it's the enemy attempt, it totally failed. If it was God kind of going, hey, you're content, even though when you were here, you were not real happy with me and you were struggling and you were crying out. I'm going, yeah, remember all that. I do. And yet his hand has led to spacious places for which I'm grateful. I don't know that I've ever had a fuller sense of contentment without doing anything. I was just sitting there and somehow I realized how contented I was. Had a moment to celebrate it. So that was fun.
That's awesome. So today we were practicing therapeutic journaling in my counseling skills class. And so I gave my students a couple of prompts and then they had to sit down and they had to journal for 15 minutes. Well, side note, It's hilarious watching Gen Zers sit down for 15 minutes to write, because most of them haven't written with a pen and paper for 15 minutes in a very, very long time. So you can see their hands are like cramping up and they're like not used to holding their pens properly. And it was hilarious. I was dying laughing.
Question though, mostly cursive or mostly printed?
Just printed. Yep.
They don't know cursive, do they?
Oh, they wouldn't know how to read cursive, let alone how to write it out. So yeah.
I saw someone recently say, how's this generation ever going to read the old documents if they hadn't learned cursive? Yeah.
They'll just scan it with their AI software and hopefully it's an accurate interpretation, I guess.
It'll convert it. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
One of the prompts that I sat down and was writing on today, it was, what do you think about when you are down or when you're in your downtime? And one of the things that I just really was processing with God about was the tension between feeling at rest in the present and the attention and the temptation to feel like I'm behind. That space is a really, especially as a 40-year-old, I feel like that space has even grown in its, I guess, my awareness of it in regards to, okay, Lord, like I don't feel like I am living my life to the tyranny of the urgent like I have in the past. I don't feel like I'm operating at that speed anymore. However, the temptation to fall into that and to get sucked into that again, to the feeling that I'm behind, that I'm not doing enough, it's still right there. It's not gone. It's not as dominating. It's not as impactful or manipulating as it has been in the past, but it is still very much a live tension in my world. And so hearing you talk about contentment, and especially looking at the things that you've navigated over the last 5 years and some of the challenges that you've navigated, and to be able to feel and experience this level of contentment.
And just turning 50, don't forget.
Correct. And just turning 50.
We had to correct some of this. I actually turned 73. So yeah.
It's encouraging to me just to see that God can continue to move that needle. And I think especially for men, that feeling of not doing enough, or I'm not enough, that I am behind, that I need to catch up, and just living in that tyranny of the urgent. I feel like that's an ever living and breathing dark passenger that men have to navigate on a regular basis. But to hear that it's waning, to hear that its influence and its impact is waning to the point of being able to sit in genuine contentment, even when having a mental review of the things that should have thrown you into victimization or frustration or doubt or depression, or, I mean, there's a whole laundry list of negative feelings that could have resulted in.
It's awesome to me. I look back and think the same things. I was your age thinking very driven, very frustrated by the thing I was involved in. And then a year and a half later, everything exploded in my life.
Is that when it happened for you, yeah, when your pastoralship blew up?
Yeah, I was 42.
Really? Okay. I didn't realize that that's how old. Okay.
And that shifted my whole trajectory. So I'm sitting here, as you're talking, thinking, I wonder what God's going to blow up in Kyle's life in the next few years. Because that's that age, you know, the mid-40s is when midlife crisis is the big joke. But you've got younger kids than would let you have a midlife crisis probably that early. But it's amazing what God can shift on a dime. And I've certainly seen that throughout my life. And yet it's always the trajectory shifts, and him at work in me through that has always brought me to a better place than where I thought I was headed. And a better pace, that slowing pace. I think the tyranny of the urgent is not so much something that comes from within. I think it's the devil on our shoulder that tries to push us into a way of living that makes it difficult to see him, to see Jesus, not see the dragon on your shoulder. That's easy to see. But I think the tyranny of the urgent come with so many good motives, evidently.
Oh, absolutely.
And to be able to live a different pace at a younger age, yes, I wish I'd done that when I was much younger. Learn to live softer.
It's intriguing to me, though, thinking about if that, like, because you had spent a fair amount of your life training to be a lead pastor, head pastor of a church. I mean, that's the craft that you had dedicated a lot of your training and life experience to, right?
Yeah.
42, to have that completely upended in a lot of ways. It's intriguing to me. Your prayer about what are you going to blow up in Kyle's life? I'm like, I don't know. Hey, I'm not sure if I'm going to allow you to pray that. First and foremost,
I'm not looking for permission.
I know you're not. but it is intriguing to me, because I think so often, as I was reflecting on moving into the decade, there's just this idea that you're supposed to have things kind of in order. You're supposed to have your trajectory lined out. You're supposed to be fairly have made a decent name for yourself in whatever field or career that you're moving into. And now these are your influence years, your 40s and 50s is where you're really, you're really making that major impact. You're moving into significant levels of leadership and authority and blah, 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 blah. And yet so many people that I talk to, they're like, oh yeah, my early 40s is when all of my plans got completely blown out of the water. That all these projections and trajectories and things that I've been working on in my 20s and 30s to try to achieve, it got all upended and major life recalibrations in my 40s. And so, yeah, it's an intriguing theme that I'm like, okay, Lord, is there something that I'm missing here? Do I need to be aware of something? Like, are you cueing something here that I wasn't aware of? I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking to Jesus this week about just all that's going on in the world and all that's going on in our home, and trying to think about planning things we need to do, and just musing with Jesus about some of those things going, I don't feel like I have any sight past today. I don't feel like I know where this is going. And so we were talking about it. I just felt like he said, you are so much better at this when you don't know what's coming.
Ooh.
And it serves me well not to show you. It serves me well, and I think it serves you well, to let it unfold. That brought a fresh content to my heart, because I was trying to, this was after the other day of contentment. This was, I just like took it to a deeper level of going, okay, so it's not like I'm missing information I should have. He doesn't want me to have it. And I'll be better in the moment if I haven't planned for it than if I have. And so I just freed me from all the trying to figure out what's ahead and what's going on with the world, and is the world going to get into World War III? What's going to happen in our economy? What? And I'll be better if I don't know, which is how that thing unfolded when Sarah was gone. Came home, not a clue. Yeah. Now it's just me and God sorting out, and 12 good friends who walked alongside me through that. But man, I look back at that whole time, because they're coming up on the 4-year anniversary of that. And I say, man, it's amazing, God, how you got me through that, what you showed me, what you taught me, how you set me at rest, how you rescued my wife, how you brought us back together, just all of that. So I'm really kind of feel free now. I just do what I need to do each day, and I'm not going to worry about what's coming, because I'll be ready when it does.
I feel like that's so, it feels so counterintuitive. I mean, even for me, as I've tried to live more in the present, not get caught up in the 5-year plans or trying to make trajectories happen, but especially with the audience that I work with, the conversation about future and next steps and where is my life going? And I just had a conversation with a student serendipitously about their adulting process and struggling with, man, this whole adulting thing is pretty rough. And that seems very, very Christ-like, and yet also very counterintuitive to a lot of the spaces that we're encouraged to try to invest time and energy and effort and musing. It's intriguing to me.
I hear you, but I think without movement in our life, I think we just sit on a couch waiting for stuff to happen to us. I just think that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So to me, the movement I had toward various things, even though I was not headed in the direction Jesus wanted me to ultimately go, the going and the preparing when the routing was changed, all that still had great value and great worth. It's not like anything was lost or wasted. I just thought we were going over there, and we were going that way, but we weren't going to get there. We were going to go here and then go that way over there. So it made me see that God's really bigger, and it doesn't hurt to have plans and thoughts and thinks we're headed a certain way. Just don't be surprised when the monkey wrench comes and all of a sudden everything I thought was going to happen doesn't. And now where do I go from here? And he's faithful. He's been faithful to just show next steps, just the next way to go. And that opened doors I would have never dreamed. And then those opened other doors that if I hadn't made the first decision back there, I don't know how I would have got back to these doors.
I see that people get caught up in the tension or the false decisions or false choices, I guess, where it's either I sit on my couch and I don't do anything and don't go anywhere, or I'm out in the world and I'm making my plans and I'm in so much movement that God has to bring in some type of life catastrophe to redirect my steps.
Like, need a roadblock. Are the two.
Yes, exactly.
Turn those the corner and there's options. A tree laying across the road. So
correct. Correct.
It reminds me of Brennan Manning's prayer. May all your expectations be frustrated. May all your plans be thwarted. May all your desires be withered into nothingness, that you may experience the powerlessness and poverty of a child and sing and dance in the love of God, who is the Father, Son, and Spirit. Talk about counterintuitive, that all your plans be frustrated. And then I look back and say, gosh, all my plans were frustrated. All my desires withered into nothingness. And then God did something so much more incredibly beautiful. And even I sit here and don't say, gosh, I got second best out of God. My gosh, yeah. I had the best journey. Having the best journey. I'm not going to go past tense yet. I'm having the best journey I know to have. And I'm grateful for it. So you got a best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
I do. Mine was actually, I was reading some memoir stuff from Tenzin Norgay. Are you familiar with him?
Nope.
He's accredited to being the first person to successfully summit Everest. Okay. He was a mountaineer, adventurer. There's some dispute on whether or not he actually was the first person, but I loved this quote that he said. He said, "I have been seriously afraid at times." This is the person who summited Everest with a fraction of the technology that we have in today's world.
Right.
"I've been seriously afraid at times, but have used my fear as a stimulating factor rather than allowing it to paralyze me." And I really appreciated that, because I feel like so often fear can be paralyzing, it can be disorienting, and yet to view it as a catalyzing behavior or a stimulating behavior, that to me is very intriguing, especially when people have navigated a space where fear has been very debilitating, to think about it in a lens where, no, this is going to actually be a positive emotion that catalyzes movement and growth and development. It's hard to fathom that being a reality. And yet I feel like that's such a healthy way to experience and walk with fear.
For me, that comes when moments of fear or the unknown or something ahead of you that's bigger challenge than you can meet.
Yes.
That's always, not always, but in my later years, has drawn me into, okay, God, how are we navigating this, you and me? If it's paralyzing, if it's just fear and God's got to change the circumstance before I gain my footing again, you'll probably never gain your footing again, the kinds of things that can happen. But if you let fear draw you back to Jesus, again, what is it about your love? I don't know. If I knew it, I wouldn't be afraid here. And then can I trust you to give me next steps through this and then see where the trajectory, see how that thing that caused fear was actually a way to open a door into a space God wanted to move you into. And if we don't let fear win the day, then we get to experience what's next. It's beautiful.
Love that. So you said you had an email about leadership.
Do I get a best thing that I get heard this week?
I thought you'd already shared it. You've shared like three things that were amazing. So what was your best thing that you heard this
week? Thank you, Kyle. this was so beautiful. When you first hear the phrase, the day of the Lord, what does that do in you? Not something you focused on much?
More so, there's a cacophony of different responses that occur inside. Because I would say now, I think of when I hear the day of the Lord, I think of hope, I think of redemption. I think of him bringing all things under alignment with his kingdom. And so there's some joy when I think of that. In the past, that's been more of judgment. You're going to get it for all the things that you've done wrong.
The world's going to get it.
The rapture and tribulation and suffering. And that's warrior on a white horse with a robe dipped in blood. those are some of the images.
I hear you.
So cacophony is how I would respond to the day of the Lord.
I hear the day of the Lord because I've done a lot of Old Testament reading where that's used to talk about some really bad stuff that's going to happen, the day of the Lord. I was in a prayer group last week and we were talking about some of this. And one of the guys in the room said, you know, the day of the Lord, this is his day. And it was like, oh my gosh, his day. This is the day he gets to shine. It just put a different spin on that phrase for me now. Whenever I hear the day of the Lord, I'm thinking, it's his day. It's like my birthday I just had, only on steroids. It's his day. It's not something to be distressed about or fearful about or have a sense of doom about. It's the day when Jesus gets to shine and finish the redemption he's begun in the world. And I don't know, it just lightened my heart, even with a phrase that in the past has not always lightened my heart. So,
yeah, I think I really like that because honestly, it's a bit of a litmus test about what do I believe about the character and the nature of God, right? Like his heart, because if I think if God gets a day, if it's his day, that whatever his will is going to be made fully and perfectly known in that moment, what do I believe is going to happen? Do I think it's going to be a doom, hellfire, and brimstone? Or do I think that it's going to be a lot of right being done, a lot of hearts being bound up and captives being set free and delight and joy, rest, love, and play? Like, is that what I see it as? Like, yeah, that's very interesting.
Well, it certainly is to celebrate all that he's accomplished in the redemption from being born to living here, to dying, to resurrecting, to working over the last 2,000 years, inviting people into his reality. And this is finally his day. This is the day when that all culminates and we will see it. We will celebrate it with him. And it just turned my heart in a lovely way. Some letters we've gotten recently. This one I got just the other day.
Okay.
It says, I figure you'd know about this some. Millions of people, particularly millennials and Gen Z, are walking away from institutional Christianity, not because they stopped believing in God, but because the version of the gospel they were handed felt empty, performance-driven, and exhausting. That's not just Gen Z. I'd say a lot of boomers have been down this road too. Yep. And then this final sentence, just love speaks directly into that wound with intellectual credibility and pastoral warmth.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is someone who says that this book needs to be aimed at that crowd.
I would, interesting. I think it would land in the millennial group versus the Gen Z group in two very different ways. Because I believe that the millennial group and then, the Gen Z and then now Gen Alpha, which would be my daughters, and their cohort of individuals.
You got to Z, so they went back to Alpha.
Back to Alpha. We'll see what they come up with as far as that goes. But the intriguing part of it is that I think the millennial generation responded the most to stepping away from organizational institutional church. I think Gen Z, on the other hand, there's a real hunger for knowing of the heart of God, knowing is there a higher power out there that genuinely cares about me, is an author of love in the world? Is that a reality? Because millennials are on the tail end of, I would say, the institutional structure having credibility and impact in family systems and lives. I think there's a lot of rejection of those systems and the idea of just follow it or go along with it because we said so. Millennials are known for being the generation that punted that. However, I think it's intriguing now watching the younger generations having a genuine hunger for what is God's love and what would God's justice in the world look like. Without some of the baggage that I think the millennial generation or the boomer generation had. It's very intriguing because I think the younger generation would say, yes, we need God's justice in the world and we need it now. I think that would be absolutely their cry. On the other side, I think millennials and boomers, having received a lot of those wounds from more of the institutionalized settings, it's almost like a vindication or a heart relief in regards to, okay, I'm not crazy. These things were not in alignment with who God's heart is or what God's heart is. And now there's just a continued vindication and affirmation that when I followed my heart, when I started to listen to my yuck meter, I wasn't the one that was going insane.
And then this letter from Florida. You are right in initially being concerned with the teachings of Toby van der Westhuizen. I wish your concern remained because Toby is close to following the God of deconstructionists who view the Word of God through a secular lens. It is not good to replace key words in Scripture to make more sense. You read on page 101, however, justice offers a wider lens than our popular ideas about righteousness. That is wrong. Though both words are similar, they are different. Replacing one with the other is definitely not a good practice. And then he quotes somebody, I don't know the guy, but some scholar who says, he has some interesting things to say about this righteousness and justice discussion. What if instead of choosing which English word to use for deoxyne, we use both of them? Perhaps it makes each verse that uses the word a bit more clunky, but doesn't it also enrich the meaning? Yeah. I think somebody missed the point here, unfortunately, but the idea of going through and choosing which word to use or trying to use them both, they have very, very different connotations.
Yeah,
they do. And I think that somebody definitely uncomfortable with moving it, definitely wished I'd trusted those initial responses. And I thought I'd let them speak their piece here. But my goodness, I'm so glad Toby and I have had the connection we've had and written the book that we have. And now involved in the discussion that we are with people who are wanting to find something that, because I think justice is a broader term than righteousness. As Toby says, everything about righteousness is inside of justice, but not everything in justice is inside of righteousness. And I think it gives a much better definition to it. Righteousness can be a very self-absorbed preoccupation. And justice by definition can't be self-absorbed.
That's one of the things that, especially when I'm thinking about the younger generation and the heart cry that I feel like that I kind of get a inkling that the Holy Spirit might be a part of authoring, is just this cry for things to be made right in the world. This cry for justice to be a lived reality instead of a begotten concept. I mean, there's this deep longing to see the violations, the tragedies, the corruption, the distortions made right in the world. And man, I love that heart cry. It's how that's going to be expressed and lived out in today's society. That's where I'm holding it loosely and saying, okay, Lord, I can't even fathom where this is going to go or what that's going to look like in the context of your kingdom and our world and where it's going. But I love that heart cry. And it's intriguing to watch how the millennial generation, when they said, no, prove it to us, right? Like, we're not just going to take things on word of mouth. We're not going to just do things because that's how they've always been done. Like, show us the why. Give us the authentic reason behind why we're doing what we're doing and form us in that. And as a result, I feel like that has taken the Gen Z and Gen Alpha has taken that conversation to the next level of saying, okay, there has been a lot of injustice in the world. There has been a lot of tragedy and violation and trauma that has occurred because we've just gone along with whatever tradition was laid forward. Now, what does it look like to see a rewriting or a reauthoring of those things? A renewing of those things.
I look for it first to come in the hearts of people because that's where the kingdom is rather than the structures of our society. Hopefully we have some import there at some point, but the idea of justice as we see it, somebody wrote this. I had an online chat with a dear friend who's a Bible translator with Wycliffe, translating the Bible into an African language. She has worked with Hebrew and Greek texts and said that the two words righteousness and justice are often used interchangeably We listened to a Jewish rabbi who explained that the Hebrew word tzedek actually had a broader meaning than either. It means righteousness and justice with love. In charity to your neighbor, it encompasses mercy, humility, and treating others well. And yeah. I think that's how we need to see justice. When we talk about bringing justice to the world, so many people hear that with vengeance. Man, correct. Let's get these bad people doing bad things and get them out of there and put in good people doing good things. But the idea of justice in mercy is not necessarily we're going to get people, but we're going to set right what's been damaged in people. That there's a whole way that God makes up in our brokenness for the healing of our lives that where damage was caused by other people. I had a conversation this week after our revisit of the Bethel thing. And one of the things that came up to me was really the great gift you give a young person when you just love them for who they are. I've had many, okay, I've known many people I met. First of all, they were children in the homes I stayed in. Yeah. And we had a brief connection there. They've grown up and the friendship has continued to deepen, that these people really have something. And I really made the great gift you can give a young person if you can befriend them and love them without any need to exploit them. And how much the exploiting of that relationship does lifelong damage in traumatic ways to people, whether it's sexual abuse or abandonment. Or when you're near a child, you have a tremendous opportunity to be a gift that will have lifelong consequences, yeah, or to use them for your own amusement and cause them to have lifetime pain. And I just, man, when you think of the Jeffrey Epstein thing and the gym coaches and the stuff that's gone on in churches from people who use the life of another person for their own amusement and take something from them they couldn't have the possibility of giving you. Yeah. And the lifelong damage that creates versus the lifelong gift you can give to someone by just loving them without any need to take something away or to exploit. I look back, I'm very, very grateful for the relationships I've had and the fun you can have and the laughter and the relaxedness with people when they don't have to be on guard and you genuinely don't have a need that they need to meet for you.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then you get to have some really wonderful relationships. Until then, leave people alone if you're going to use them for your own amusement somehow. And this from a friend. I thought this was interesting. The autistic boy was with us for a short season. They had someone around the foster care, I think, that was autistic. Okay. But when he was with us, he had a vision. He told me he saw me in a church facing the altar. Jesus was there, but I couldn't see him, for a beast stood in front of him. This is an autistic kid, had this little vision. So I chose to worship the beast. That's what the kid told her. You chose to worship the beast because that's all you could see. I couldn't understand at the time. As years went by, it became clear to me that the beast was religion. In my case, in the guise of the Catholic Church, it so fits today and with your message. The idea of missing the beast getting in front of Jesus. That's a powerful image.
That is a very powerful image. That makes me think of a couple of images, ideas that I have encountered over the last few years in regards to whether, like, especially with trauma, people being having a very hard time to be able to see Christ and the love of Christ because the trauma is standing in between them and the love of God. And having that pain, having that whatever event it was or experience it was, basically eclipse God's movement and presence in their life, in their world. It's hard when I was talking with an individual the other day about the victim mentality and the difference between being victimized and living in the victim space and how deeply caught up you can get in the idea of being a victim and how that space and how it becomes all of a sudden it becomes so intoxicating because it's like, oh, well, this is deeply integrated into my identity. I am a victim. And then you start looking for ways to reaffirm that identity, either by either consciously or unconsciously putting yourself in positions where you are getting harmed again and again repeatedly, or you're just looking for that that's constantly a part of your lens, and how quickly it eclipses and dominates people's lives versus the idea that, yes, I was victimized, by someone else, but that's not the final word in my story. That doesn't have the final word on my identity in Christ or even my ability to relate with Christ.
That's not always easy to communicate, is it?
No.
Because people hear that if you've been genuinely victimized and it has taken, stolen something from you for a significant part of your life, yeah, and may still be doing that. And if you talk about it, people just say, oh, you can't just be a victim. You got to move on. It can sound dismissive to the person who's been victimized.
Very much so.
But I hope they can hear past it to what you're saying. It's one thing to be a victim of someone else's abuse, evil, darkness.
Yep.
And it's another thing to take that on as an identity that defines your behavior going forward. Instead of, I'm not that person. I was victimized, but I'm a beloved child of a gracious Father. And how do I find myself moving toward that reality? Because that's so important. Whether it's whether it's trauma, it might be religious abuse, which you wouldn't necessarily specify as trauma, but you've grown up, you've given your whole life to this religious performance treadmill. You thought you were doing all the right stuff, that this performance treadmill was built on the authority of the scriptures. So God wanted you working hard and exhausting yourself. And then you find out that the people who were driving it all had feet of clay. They weren't even trying to live it themselves. And you get exhausted and then you get angry. And it's always whatever is our beast. That's a good thing probably to look at and say, what is the beast that's in front of me that keeps me from seeing Jesus? And it rarely looks like a beast. The angel of light in scripture is a beautiful thing because the enemy just comes in. He's not real dark, evil, nasty, cussing, swearing. He's going to come in mimicking light to draw you away from seeing who God is and what he wants to do in your life and how he's making himself known in you. And so I hope people hear that, realize, man, I don't want to be a victim. I was a victim, but I'm not going to take my identity from that. I'm going to, and I watch Sarah do it every day. I watch her have the courage to keep moving toward wholeness, even though she said, I don't know if I'm ever going to get there in this lifetime. And I don't know either. And I don't put that pressure on her. But do we see progress? Do we see us having more freedom today than we had last year? And if so, that's a good trajectory to be on and to take your definitions there.
And I think that's one of the defining distinctions between the two, is that somebody who's been victimized, they are moving towards and seeking out help to be healed from that experience. They're not diminishing the amount of time that it's going to take. They're not diminishing the impact that that had on their lives. They're honoring the extent to which they were victimized. But a victim is not seeking help. They're not seeking healing. They're seeking affirmation and reaffirmation for that identity. And that's a big distinction between the two.
It is. And maybe that'll help people kind of determine where that is. And I think there can be great struggle to kind of find your way into getting the beast out of your eyesight and being able to focus freely on who Jesus is and how he's coming to you. I know one of the things you described, I think it was you described early on about trauma, or someone else did, it's like plumbing that doesn't work. It's just backed up. So everything hits your life, it just keeps backing up on the same pain you've already had. And one of the first things I think good trauma work does is it kind of unplugs the pipe. It kind of lets stuff flow through you instead of getting stuck inside you.
Yes.
And how does that happen for people? What are some things that help people if they feel like that? I just feel all backed up. I feel like everything's just stuck and every new thing that happens piles on the old things that happen. How do we find movement there to help people embrace God's light coming into that place?
That's a good question. It's hard to give a blanket response to that.
I understand.
Because God's so unique in the way that he unplugs that. I think one of the characteristics that I see God do with that, and I would love your feedback on this, is that he does start with a redefining or a recasting of the identity. Because at least for me, when I'll share a little bit about my space when I was navigating that unplugging of the plumbing, first and foremost, that first really huge encounter that I had, that collision with the Holy Spirit, that divine collision, was being seen in my mess, seeing the pain, the clog, the disaster, and feeling so deeply loved. That God came in and changed the core element of my identity of, I'm a mess, I'm broken, I'm a disaster, I'm pain. Those were a lot of the identity statements previously to that.
Or the more emotional words that come with that, I'm disgusting.
Absolutely.
The whole self-loathing thing. Yeah, yes. It's huge.
Yeah, shame and self-loathing, yeah. Self-hatred. I mean, the list goes on and on. In the midst of that, God's love for me, seeing all of that and saying, you're still loved. You are still worthy of my love. You are still worthy to be delighted in. That flipped the script for me in a very powerful way. And I think for a lot of people who are navigating trauma and are navigating getting that trauma unplugged, a big piece of the trauma is what it says about them. That's why it's so hard to get that trauma unplugged, is because the narrative goes to their identity. It goes to who they are, goes to their value, goes to the core makeup of why they exist in the world.
Yeah.
And so to have God start to flip that script and starting with his love, starting with his delight, that to me has consistently been, as I've observed it in other people's lives and as I've observed it in my own life, that's one of the primary themes that I see God starting off with, is let's flip the script on who you think you are and let me show you how I see you through my unrelenting, unconditional love.
Yeah, and it is the one thing you can't provide a substitute for. It begins with not just the theology of God's love, it's an experience of presence inside that affection.
Yes.
If God's going to set the world right, our first response to that as humans is the vengeance side of, let's get the people who've done bad stuff. Yep. Instead of, that means God's going to make it up to Sarah for what happened to her. That Joel passage about what the locusts have destroyed, I'm going to replenish, whatever. Yeah. I think that's real important. And it may not be all true in this lifetime for Sarah.
Correct.
I can't wait to see what Sarah's eternity is like. If there's rewards in heaven, the way we've talked about, we always talk about that, oh, the super achievers, man, they get all these big awards. Yeah. I wonder if it's the people that have endured great pain.
Yeah.
And been the focus of someone else's flesh and been devastated by it. I don't wonder if part of the way God does justice in the world is he makes up to the broken what was stolen from them. And if people who are feeling really stuck, and maybe even because of this podcast, they feel like, okay, I see a beast between me and Jesus, or even worse, as this lady was, I'm looking at the beast thinking it's Jesus.
Yeah.
Which is a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
You'll know it's Jesus when you feel loved and safe and contented inside that love, even though you've still got the mess to unravel.
Correct.
Or he's got the mess to unravel, is better said.
Yeah.
And that's where I would encourage people, man. If that's where it's got to start. And if you're trying to just get around it mentally or read enough books or try and get the right thoughts in your head and you're fighting this as a mental game, lay that down. I think what you want to do is say, Jesus, would you reveal yourself to me? And would you reveal the Father's love to me? And don't try to recreate your experience or my experience. Yes. Let Jesus have his own experience with you. And pause enough to invite that to happen. Not because it won't happen until you invite it, but it's almost that we won't recognize it until we invite it. Jesus is always trying to speak that love to you. And it mostly goes past us because we've got this big beast in front of us that doesn't let us see. And if we could just pause enough, suspend our belief system about ourselves, what you're saying, enough to say, Jesus, reveal yourself to me. And then give him space to do that. Don't demand it happen in the next second or the next week or month. Let him bring his love to you. And if you've got a good friend, trauma gets embedded in people because it's unwitnessed pain. And if you got somebody you can invite into that pain to witness with you and own with you what you've been through, and then be able to help you see the Jesus who's revealing himself to you right in the midst of it, that might be really helpful for people who are feeling stuck on this journey instead of being able to find their contentment in him.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.